Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we have two guests, but not together. Rebecca Luker is going to join us, as well as William Blake. We also talk about A Night with Janis Joplin, The Winslow Boy, Romeo and Juliet, The Classic Stage Company, Fun Home, and How to Be a New Yorker. So please stay tuned.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees, putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 20th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. Rebecca Luker is joining us, and we know Rebecca from her many appearances on Broadway, starting way back at Phantom of the Opera, and to these days where she's appearing in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella on Broadway. So good morning, Rebecca. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us on a Sunday morning. So tell us, you went into Cinderella recently. What's it like revisiting the classics?
Oh, my goodness. My first performance was September 6th, and it was a very fast put-in, but I'm having a time of my life, honestly. It's just the best job. It's the most fun I've ever had, really, in a job, and that's saying a lot. So it's a great show. You know, the score is classic, beautiful. But you know, with the rewrite on the book by Douglas Carter Bean, it's really so much fun to do.
And that whole revisiting of Cinderella, have you ever done a different production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella?
I did back in 1986 at the Kansas City Starlight. I did Cinderella, the role of Cinderella.
Yeah.
The
traditional,
the show that's usually done. Yeah.
And
yeah, before this one.
Well, I think there are several different versions, several different stage versions.
I think there are. Yeah.
Over the years, it's been rewritten and rewritten, and different songs put in, and it was done at least twice at City Opera, I think.
Mm. Oh yes, right. This must be Cinderella 6 or something. I don't know.
Yeah, 6.0.
But it was fun to start off as Cinderella and now be the fairy godmother, which is so fun.
Well, and the crazy lady too. I mean, that must be very interesting as well.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's really the first time I've ever gotten to play two characters on stage, but B, one of them be a real character. You know,
so much.
I mean, it was so different, and I wondered why I hadn't done it before. It was so great to do.
Well, can we maybe talk about, it's just in the news about how you, the beauty of your voice quieted this horrible drama.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
You said that on Tumblr.
No. Yes, what a crazy article. Paul Winkler blogged about that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know what? I don't know that that's true, but that was very nice of him to write that. if he was quiet for a second, who knows why that was the case. You know, he could have been taking a drink out of a flask or something. I have no idea. But apparently this guy was a real troublemaker, and just, you know, I heard about the rest of the story, you know, after the whole event, you know.
So the house manager had sort of
he had a kerfuffle with the
gentleman.
Yes, I believe he hit him in the face, you know, and the poor guy, he's fine, but he wears glasses, so could have been a lot worse.
It was the gentleman that hit the house manager.
Yes,
yes.
Make that clear.
It wasn't the other way
around. Oh, no, not the other way around.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's rare for us to have an audience member like that. Too bad. But even the house manager, though, invited him back. He said, you can bring your four-year-old daughter back sometime. Very nice of him to do that, you know. If you behave, this was the unspoken.
You know, so you had some experience in Mary Poppins with younger audience members as well, you know.
Oh, yes.
What's that? Did you have any comparable stories there, or did Disney's got it down? They just lock these things.
They just got it down. No, we had a lot of rowdy kids in the audience, and you just got, especially on matinees, the cast just got used to all the noise, and it's weird. It's difficult at first to concentrate, but you just sort of learn to concentrate. But the Cinderella audiences aren't like that at all. They seem to be pretty, well behaved for the most part. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's interesting because I think in the very beginning, when Cinderella on Broadway was doing their marketing, they really tried to make it clear that it wasn't the Disney Cinderella version that was out there. So I think the marketing has been towards more families bringing in their kids rather than school tours.
Absolutely. It's definitely a script for the whole family, for adult. In fact, kids don't get a lot of the jokes, I'm sure. I mean, it's very, adult oriented, I think.
So maneuvering that dress, changing, was that hard? Did that take a long time? What?
It didn't take that long. William Ivy Long and company have it sewed down now that, after months of perfecting it, that I just walked in and was the lucky recipient of all the problems that had been worked out.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a few rehearsals in it, and literally only a few. And then I was thrown out on stage in front of an audience, and it always works. It's amazing. I feel like I'm in the middle of a magic trick, and I am. I know how to do it, but I still don't know how it works. It's just the craziest thing. Mm-hmm. So crazy.
So let's have a flashback, if we can. To Phantom of the Opera and your introduction to the Broadway audience.
Yes.
Tell us how that happened. How did you go from Alabama to New York?
Excuse me, but Rebecca Luker is in the Alabama Stage and Screen Hall of Fame, and I was there for
the production. That's right. Peter Felicia was there. Oh, my gosh. We rode around in a limo together.
Yes, we did.
with the kids from To Kill a Mockingbird, by the way.
Right.
What a hoot. That weekend was crazy. Well, I moved to New York in 1985 after I met my soon-to-be agent, Brett Adams, in Detroit. It's a long story, but I was doing something with the Detroit office. I was an intern. He saw me and said, I'd love to be your agent if you moved to New York. Judy Kay introduced us, wonderful woman. And so I moved to New York. I scraped up some money and moved in with a friend in 1985. And so I had an agent right away, which helped me immensely. So when Phantom came along in 87 to audition everybody, I got an audition. And, I was just the right voice, the right age, the right type at the time. So I was cast as Sarah Brightman's understudy. And it was a wonderful place to start. And so for about 9 months, I worked really hard and then moved up through the ranks and became Christine. And that's how that happened. Yeah.
Were you in Phantom before Judy or at the same time?
At the same time. Judy and I were both in the original company.
Original cast, that's right.
Yeah, that opened in January of 88. Yeah, and still running.
still running. See, I told you, you're only 12.
And I was 12, that's right.
Exactly. so what's
No, that? it was a great experience.
During your Phantom time, you got the ability to make your way out into the rest of the Broadway community, and you ended up was the next show for you Secret Garden? So you moved across the street?
It was. Mm-hmm. I moved right across the street. That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was in Phantom for 3 years, and then I got Lily, which was so wonderful. I mean, what a great, my first original role, and it was such a beautiful show.
I keep coming back to that recording, Rebecca. Like,
such
I'll just suddenly... Oh. Suddenly decide to put it on and I'm on a train somewhere and I'm weeping.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it is a beautiful score that Lucy Simon, Marcia Norman wrote. I mean, it just stunning.
I think it's a shame that they didn't make a film of it. And it was ironic because I seem to remember that right around the time that the show opened, there was a non-musical film.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right around the same time, just after we opened. That's exactly right. And I know, I wish, you know, we never did. That is such a shame. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous production in every way, I think.
And then after that, you moved a little bit uptown around 50th Street to Showboat. And,
that's right.
Working with Hal Prince and Susan Stroman and
Elaine Stretch.
Was Elaine in there? I forgot about Elaine.
She was the original Parthy. She was Elaine in there. Are you?
Yeah.
She played my mother. Can you imagine? I know. We're so alike. Yes. She was so great. She was, what an experience that was. I mean, just, you know, amazing. But I wasn't laughing at her, you know, it was just crazy.
Oh, you know.
She was great.
Lots of wonderful
stories. Laughing with her, I should say.
Lots of wonderful stories came out of that production that we will not tell on the air.
Exactly. Yes, we probably shouldn't.
All the phone calls to Hal's office, you know.
I know. Oh, Lord.
So, you're taking, you've gone from an original production that opened on the West End and came to New York, and then an original production that you originated, but then you visited a classic musical that's been done so many times. You know, how is your process different in imagining Magnolia and Showboat?
Well, it's not so very different. Showboat also has many incarnations, and this was an original, this was a production that, you know, it could be 4 hours long, Showboat, but of course, you know, we had to pair it. I think there have been four hour long, yes, 4 hour long productions. But, basically my process is what it is with every role, be it something that's never been done or something that's been done a million times. You try to find the truth of the character. You bring yourself to it. It's always going to be different because you do it. That's, you know, it sounds simple, but, you know, it's listening, it's, you know, doing, just trying to make the character real, and that's how I look at it every time, you know.
So, let's jump off the Broadway shows right now and talk about another one of our guests that we had on this podcast a year or so ago, that Danny Burstein guy. You know, he's nothing but trouble, I have to tell you.
Yeah, he's nothing but trouble. Nothing I know, but isn't trouble. Isn't he wonderful?
So,
I know. He's sitting in the next room.
How did you guys originally meet to do a show together?
So he's typing a letter to Sarah Paulson right now. they're good buddies from Tally's Folly.
Yeah.
We did meet doing a show. We actually met doing Time and Again at the Old Globe. That show that never came into Broadway, but it was such a great score, and we were just friends way back then. There were about five of us that hung together out there: Howard McGillin and Jessica Malasky and George Dvorsky and me and Danny. And then it really wasn't until about a year and a half later that we started dating during Harmony, the Barry Manilow show.
Yeah.
And then we got together then. So in like around 87, some 97 sometime. And never look back, you know.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
It turned out he was my soulmate. You know?
So what's it like having a two Broadway performer family? You know, who you're all running out at 7:30.
I know. Exactly. Oh, just like any other family, you know. We're as normal as they come, you know. It's great though. I mean, we have similar schedules. We understand each other. We help each other. We appreciate each other's work, you know. It's just
after Time and
it's wonderful.
Did you guys work together after Time and Again?
We have done we did Harmony. Where we started dating during that, and then other than that, Danny, we've never done a show together. Well, Danny's directed me in all my solo concerts, and we've done little comedy duets on albums and benefits and things like that. But we've not done anything big. I'd love to do like a play with Danny. I would love that.
Huh.
He would make me better, you know.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm his biggest fan. Can you tell?
Well, that works for everybody.
That's a good thing. Yes, good thing.
And so tell us about what happened with Nine and how.
Nine? Gosh, yes, that was a replacement situation too. The Cinderella is my second time to do that. And you know, a lot of people say, why do you replace in things? I think I think if it's a great show, why not? You know?
Yeah.
You can't always be the original person, you know, either you're not available and if it's a wonderful project, Nine came along. I did the last 3 or 4 months of it only, but I got to do it with the original company before Cheetah left and before Antonio Banderas left. So it was wonderful. You know, I actually went in and auditioned for The Wife, and then that didn't work out, and I came back to audition for Claudia, I should say. Uh-huh. And then David, you know, his name just fell out of my head.
LeBeau,
we had a little private meeting, and he asked me some questions, and I got the part, which is, you know, I have to say, I'm so different from Laura Benanti, who originated the role, that I'm very grateful to a director who can cast so differently in a role. You know, that's not often the case, and you know, we're different in every way, and I was very appreciative of that. And I got to wear a long, dark wig and be Italian, and it was just, you know, it was a really fun 3 or 4 month experience. Yeah.
Well, that's great. So, as we mentioned at the top, you're in Cinderella now. I think you're scheduled through January or so.
That's right. January 19th is my last show.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And, what else is coming up for you? Anything exciting?
Well, the biggest thing that's coming up is the new Aarons and Flaherty show called Little Dancer, which is going to the Kennedy Center in the fall of 2014, and Stroman is directing and choreographing, and it's a wonderful new show about Degas and that, you know, the Paris Ballet and the little girl that posed for him and the famous Little Dancer, and I play the adult version of her. Marie Van Gertem is her name. She's an actual person. It's a true story. It's I'm very excited about it. It's going to be great. And hopefully it'll come into Broadway. We'll see.
Yeah, there's it sounds like a project just made for coming to Broadway.
it does, doesn't it? I mean, it's going to be beautiful. It's moving. It's the score is so gorgeous. Their score.
And when is that? Yeah. Did I miss the date?
So fall of 2014 will be in at the Kennedy Center.
Okay.
I believe I start rehearsing out there in September. Not sure what the dates are exactly, but I'm out there for a few months, and then hopefully hear again. Yeah.
I guess Aarons and Flaherty are really busy. I mean, Rocky is, you know, it's
yeah.
written
aren't
by
they?
Now.
They're a busy pair, as is Susan Stroman. Amazing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, gotta find out what vitamins she takes. You know. Wow.
Rebecca, right? The performance I will never forget of yours was on the 13th. Of September in 2001. I went to the Music Man as the first performance to go to after 9/11.
Yes.
And you may recall there were about 150, 200 people in the house that night. And I was really interested to see how it would play. You've got trouble right here in River City. Indeed, we had a good deal of trouble here. And yet you people were such amazing pros. I have never forgot that you really worked so hard as if nothing had happened. And I remember waiting for you and John Sloman at the stage door. And as all of you were filing out, that's when the tears were flowing. It was an astonishing thing to see, you know, that all of you were
goodness.
So moved. But for those 2 hours, you gave that 150, 200 people audience an escape. And we were all very grateful that you
Peter.
Did.
Thank you, Peter. It was, I believe a lot of those people in the audience were firemen, families, people like that. I mean, it was, it was the God Bless America at the end, you know, when the flag drops. That got us. That was a little hard to get through every night. But thank you so much. It was, what a time that was, boy. And I loved that show so much. It's one of my favorite experiences ever. Mm-hmm. Just love that show.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on
a
Sunday morning.
Thank you, James and Michael and Peter. Thank you all so much.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Lovely to talk to you.
We'll speak to you soon. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
It's so much fun to have Rebecca with us this morning. And I'm looking forward to seeing her in Cinderella. It's a fun show. I know.
May I tell a Rebecca story?
Please
I didn't, I didn't want to go into it, but when she was on, because I didn't want to embarrass her in any way. But
sure.
I mean, this is a good story. It really is. When she was doing Sound of Music, I was asked to do a story on the child wrangler in the show. You know, the responsibilities
sure, yeah.
of the person who has to make sure that the kids are in the right place in the right time and all that kind of business. So anyway, it was amazing to me to be in the bowels of the Martin Beck Theater. And the thing is that Susan Shulman, not the one we had on a few weeks ago talking about her book, a director named Susan Shulman, I don't know how much thought she really gave to the fact that so many entrances and exits were on different sides of the stage, and people had to continue run downstairs through the basement and up the stairs to the other side to enter. So anyway, at one point, I was down there with the kids, and suddenly Rebecca stormed through to make her entrance. And she's not used to seeing this person here, and she was just so intent in running with her head down that she banged into me. And I apologized. And so, all right, it's the second act now, and I'm at the back of the house, meaning in the lobby. And you may recall that they were in the lobby too for the processional as the traps are getting married. And there she is, and she sees me from afar, and she actually comes over to me and says, "I am so sorry that I bumped into you." And I said, "I was in your way. You know, I mean, I shouldn't have been there." You know, and I just thought it was so amazing that she would take time out when she was just about ready to walk down the aisle, literally, to come over to me and apologize when no apology was necessary. She really is quite a classy lady. And when we were at the Alabama Stage and Screen Hall of Fame, it was an amazing night for her because, yeah, she didn't go to one of these prestige universities. And for her to come as far as she has with not that pedigree is really quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, of course, that she has genuine talent. And it was very nice to see her admitted into that Hall of Fame that night. So, and of course, every time I see her, she always says, "It's nice bumping into you."
Well, I want to point out that so many of these wonderful stories we tell about these folks who are working on Broadway, this is not out of the ordinary for a Rebecca Luker. You know, you hear these stories about this type of person, the Mark Kudishes, the Brian D'Arcy Jameses, you know, the Laura Benantes, those folks, they work on Broadway not only because they're extremely talented, but because they are such wonderful people. You know, and
yes,
and
but I could tell plenty of stories about people who work who aren't wonderful. That's another
absolutely.
Story.
But you know what? They don't. I have to look at some stats and look at this, but I feel like some of those people that you and I know that we can tell such terrible stories about, they don't work as often as the Rebecca Lukers.
And I also think, I could be wrong, I think there is less of that now than there used to be for some reason. I think people recognize that kind of thing is just not really acceptable. And I know the point has been made in terms of directors specifically. I think the days of the, you know, the really, really autocratic Jerome Robbins type of thing, I think that's over, you know, and I mean, that's a separate issue from how talented those people are, obviously. But don't you think that, you know, also, I don't know. I mean, maybe now you might have a case where a movie star might come to Broadway and might behave that way. But I like to think that it's really not very common nowadays.
I agree with you. I think it is less common that people are temperamental and push their weight around in that way. I don't hear nearly as many stories as I used to way back when about this type of behavior. That is very true. I also remember being in the casting session for Rags when it came down to Larry Kurt and somebody else. And Larry Kurt, who, to be frank, had a reputation of being difficult in his early years and found out it was doing him no good. I will never forget the when they were finally making their decision, that Gene Sack said, "Oh, let's cast Larry. At least we'll know we'll have fun." And I mean, that was so interesting to hear that indeed his being a person who represented fun was the deciding factor that got him the job, that he would be easy to work with. And I think that's not irrelevant. And I bet that happens far more often than we may think.
With us today, we have a special second guest. William Blake is joining us, who is a singer, and he's got a performance coming up at Birdland Jazz Club on October 28th at 7 p.m., where he's going to be putting on his show Echoes of Etta 2. William, thanks for joining us on Sunday morning.
Thank you. Good morning to you as well.
So tell us about the show coming up at Birdland. What is it?
It's sort of a continuation of a show that we began at Birdland last year in June. It's just the material of Etta James from her songbook, if you will. And it's just an exploration of her 55-year career span. And it's songs that me and my collaborator, Michael Thomas Murray, sort of, we did a lot of research and legwork as to the songs that she performed and in that, you know, time span, and we just picked and choose and chose the songs that we enjoyed so much and the songs that we could relate to. And that's basically the show that we've been doing for the past year and a half now. And we're calling it Echoes of Etta 2 because we're going to be doing some new tunes, newer tunes for us, as well as previewing a new show called Always Aretha with our three backup singers that we call the Peaches. And so we're very excited to be doing some new tunes as well as the preview of this next show.
Well, Etta James just died last year after that amazing career you mentioned. And of course,
correct,
Aretha Franklin is very much with us. But are you aware,
yes,
William, that both of these women make an appearance on Broadway right now in A Night with Janis Joplin?
Oh, I did read something about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, in the person of, let's see, Alison Blackwell plays Aretha and Nikki Kimbrough plays Etta James. So I just thought it's you might want to know that. You might want to check it out.
Crossover there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, Etta actually spoke about it in her book Rage to Survive, that Janis Joplin would come in and sit in on her rehearsals and she learned so much from watching and listening to a woman like Etta. She was, you know, a very vivacious performer, as was Janis. So, you know, I like to think that she pulled a little bit of inspiration from her. So
tell
yeah,
me,
definitely.
Yeah. So tell me about the Aretha Franklin show that you have coming up. When is that?
Well, it's a show that, that Michael's developing.
Uh-huh.
And so it's, what we're doing is having the three wonderful girls that we lovingly refer to as the Peaches. It's Ashley, Benton, Shira, mm-hmm, Elias, and Stephanie Mora.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to be presenting the songs. And so it's going to be a chance for them to not just sing back up in the show on the 28th, but to stand out front and actually solo and do a number on their own. And because individually they're such great vocalists, they're such great technicians. And so we're very thrilled that they're going to be able to, you know, be in the spotlight for this next show. So they're going to be able to, you know, present that material and sort of give people a feel as to what that show is going to be like when we do it next. So, which, you know, Mike will have to tell you all about that.
So I'm reading from your bio that you made an appearance on American Idol, and and that you also did some a show at Carnegie Hall with Michael Feinstein. And so tell us about those two things quickly.
Well, I did American Idol back in 2004. That was the Carrie Underwood year.
Uh-huh.
And I did end up going to Hollywood. It was a very cool experience. You know, it was... it was just different. You know, I'm not used to having a camera follow me around and things like that. And there was so much singing going on. It was kind of ridiculous. But it was both a positive experience. I took a lot from it. So that happened, and at the insistence of people. So I said, okay, I auditioned for American Idol. I did it. I went to Hollywood. Now, will you please kindly shut up? So, so it was something I did, many years ago. And then, the Carnegie Hall experience was definitely, a wonderful one at that. I was asked by Michael, he came in on a cast party night. You know, Jim Caruso's cast party is something that happens every Monday at Birdland. And he came in, heard me sing, and then I got a phone call asking if I wanted to join him at Zankel Hall at Carnegie Hall. So it was definitely a highlight of my career thus far. It's something that I often harken back to and think about, and it was just a great experience. And Michael's such a warm and affectionate and just gifted and talented performer. So it was an honor.
Well, great. So I want to remind everybody that you can check out William Blake at WilliamBlakeSings.com or on Twitter at Willie B. Singer, W-I-L-L-Y, the letter B, Singer, S-I-N-G-E-R on Twitter as well. And his show is coming up October 28th at 7 p.m. at Birdland. And you can go to birdlandjazz.com for tickets and information. So thanks for joining us, William. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Have a good day.
Bye.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So let's move on to our reviews of shows, things that we've seen. And we had a triple play here. Peter, Michael, and I got a chance to see A Night with Janis Joplin. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Janis?
Oh, thanks.
Shall I start it? Peter, do you want to start?
No, I will. I'm just being silly. First of all, let it be said, and I don't think anyone would disagree, that Mary Bridget Davies, who is the primary of two people playing the role of Janis Joplin, is uncanny in her impersonation, if that's the right word, her channeling of Janis Joplin. She doesn't look exactly like her, but she looks close enough that, you know, it'll do. And the vocal impression, it's absolutely extraordinary. And her intensity and her energy, the audience is just amazed, I think, at what she's doing up there. But, there are so many problems here. First of all, the show isn't maybe quite as killingly, horribly loud as I feared it would be, but it's close. And the guy in front of me was handing out earplugs at intermission. I guess he had extra, and he turned around to a few people and said, "Would you like some earplugs?" And a few people took him up on it. You know, I mean, and on top of that, there is this. This has got to stop. This new thing of shining lights in the audience's eyes. I mean, directly in the audience's eyes, where you have to look away if not to be blinded. So there were several points in Act Two where I had to go to another place. I had to really zone out and like close my eyes and put my hands in my ears because I didn't take any earplugs from that fellow because I think he was out by that point. And I don't think why do we assault the audience? And they also assaulted the audience, especially in Act Two, with this, you know, really annoying thing of having one or more of the cast members harangue us to clap along and chant along, and if we don't do it loud enough the first time they do it, they say, "Oh, you know, what's going on, you people out there? You know, I said, are you having a good time?" You know, and then they'll do it again, and then, you know, until it's what they think is sufficient response.
I'm gonna disagree with you there, Michael. I think that no matter how loud the response. It's never good enough. They always say, "I said, how are you doing?" You know, it's never good enough. So it doesn't matter whatsoever. So anyway, I'm sorry. Go on.
No. I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think they're pretending that it's not enough. You know, I mean, even if the first response was the entire theater shaking with people screaming and yelling, mm-hmm. they would still do it again because that's what they've been told to do or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was a very assaultive evening. The individual numbers were great, but there's no dramatic arc to the show. I did like the fact, and it obviously gave a break to Miss Davies, that they had other cast members playing these other singers who were apparently great influences on Janis Joplin, including Bessie Smith, Nina Simone, Odetta, and Aretha Franklin. And Etta James, did I say that? Yeah. So that was good, and I thought that, you know, that gave us a chance to hear other kinds of music. Whoever thought, I never expected to hear the Rodgers and Hart song "Little Girl Blue" in A Night with Janis Joplin, and like very, very beautifully sung by Deidra Aziza in the role of Nina Simone. So that was great, but really no dramatic arc, no dealing with Janis's dark side, almost completely avoided. The dark side, you know, that caused her to overdose at 27. And, you know, I had forgotten that. I guess I knew it at the time, but I'd forgotten because it was like 1969 or 70, whatever, that her big hit, Me and Bobby McGee, actually was a posthumous hit. She was already dead by the time that became a hit, which is so amazing to me. But major problems when you try to do this kind of thing on Broadway. Aside from everything else, there's the thing that, you know, if every number is pitched at such a fever pitch with the person, you know, wailing at the top of their lungs, what kind of... there's nowhere to go. I mean, if that starts at the beginning and every song that she sings is like that, it becomes, rather than exciting, it becomes annoying and you just recoil from it. At least I do. I mean, you know, in Dreamgirls, Jennifer Holliday has two numbers like that. But there's one at the end of the first act and then there's one in the second act. And there are all these other numbers in between where people are not wailing and screaming like that. And I guess it's partly the American Idol syndrome. I mean, has made that more acceptable. Obviously, Janis Joplin was around long before American Idol. But I think that's something that people don't realize when they do this kind of music on Broadway. It's not dramatic music. There's no way to differentiate between one number and one screaming, wailing, intense number and the other. And that's why, as I said, I really had to zone out at one point.
Yeah. So, Peter, what'd you think about it?
Well, I don't think we can judge this as a theatrical show. It's a rock concert that happens to have booked the Lyceum. That's really what it is. And the thing about the lights flashing on the audience, that's rock concert stuff. The fact that it's a fever pitch, yeah, that's rock concert stuff. And people who go to rock concerts want to be able to show that they can survive them. That as much as thrown at them, they can survive them. And my friend Ken Bloom, the author of 101 Greatest Musicals, was saying recently, what people want on Broadway now is energy. That's the most important component to the audience today. That's what they're looking for, is energy. And if you want energy, yeah, there it is at the Lyceum. There's no question. I don't know very much about Janis Joplin. I do recall seeing the movie Monterey Pop and being very impressed at the energy and the charisma that she showed in that picture. And I do know that this actress is really doing an astonishing job at sounding like her, and to a degree looking like her, though hair always helps those things, as we learned from Forbidden Broadway. If you have the right hair, it's you know, 75% of the situation. But, you know, I mean, it's certainly a case where we have to accept this for what it is. It is A Night with Janis Joplin. There's truth in advertising there. It's she was as Michael said, she brings in Bessie Smith and Nina Simone and all that. But you know, early in the show, she talks about the fact that when she was growing up, her mother loved original cast albums.
Yes.
West Side Story, My Fair Lady. So I would have enjoyed some visits from Maria and Anita and Eliza Doolittle and Henry Higgins. I think that would have helped the show immeasurably if we had had some visits from them as well as Nina Simone, et cetera. So, I think it should do business. I certainly have... Miss Davies on my list of Broadway debuts for next year's Theater World Awards, the season's early and who knows, but nevertheless, I think the show is going to do very well with the audience that it's intended for, and good luck to it.
Well, Peter, I absolutely know what you mean, but I'm not sure I agree about not judging it as a Broadway show, because, I mean, it is framed as a dramatic piece. It's, by the way, written and directed by Randy Johnson, who has done, I believe, a few other of these kind of homage shows to various music icons. And, you know, I mean, there is dialogue and she is speaking with us and they do, she does talk about her childhood and her influences. It's not really a concert, because a concert doesn't have written dialogue.
Oh, I don't know about that. I wouldn't be surprised if when Janis Joplin actually performed that she told us about her life in between. Patter is certainly a
well, part of the concert. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
it may even be amazingly historically accurate for all you and I know that this might even been words that she had said in between. I certainly see your point, you know, but when all is said and sung, it certainly the apportionment of music to patter is far greater. So it's enough for me to judge on the side that this is a concert.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, I just want to chime in that pretty much not everything that you guys have said I agree with. I go to Broadway shows to see a play or a book musical. I'm really not there for a concert. And so that threw me off there. And this was really tremendously amazing talent on stage that I just was less interested in, because it really wasn't a presentation of a story as much as I would like it to have been. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I think what Peter said is true, that this will find some sort of an audience. I'm not sure it'll be a Broadway audience for the long haul. It's not going to be a long-running show, but I think that it toured around before it came into Broadway, and I think it'll tour around after it leaves Broadway, and we'll have to see.
Yeah, I don't know if it won't be long-running. Certainly, I have seen from regional theaters around the country that one of their most successful shows in the past 10, 15 years has been always Patsy Cline.
Yeah.
This is certainly analogous to that in some ways. Granted, the two artists were very different in their approach and all that, but my point is the type of show it is brings in people who want to see. The name is there. They know they like that person. They want to see if the person could replicate. They want to see how close the person could come to replicating the image that they have. They also want to go back in time, you know, needless to say, to when they were younger and these were their heroes. And fine, you know, I mean, it's that type of show. So I'm not sure it's going to leave Broadway so quickly. And I won't be surprised if it gets a million productions here and there, just as almost Patsy Cline. I know a theater where... they do traditional musicals, and yet always Patsy Cline was the one that broke the house record. So, this is what people want to see.
By the way, Randy Johnson, I'm looking at his bio now. It says was the original producer of Always Patsy Cline.
Oh,
that's right. Yeah.
So there you go. And, you know, not to go on and on, but aside from everything else that we just said, I mean, the main reason why this is a show rather than a concert is, at the risk of stating the obvious, it's not really Janis Joplin up there.
Yeah.
I mean, I presume that Miss Davies will be eligible for all the theater awards. Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. You know, and so in that sense, it's very much a
even though we may fault it in many ways, it is a dramatic theatrical piece over and above being primarily a concert.
Next up, Peter and I got to see The Winslow Boy actually last night at the American Airlines Theater on 42nd Street. So, Peter, tell me, what did you think about The Winslow Boy?
I was tremendously disappointed. And I know this production has received wonderful reviews, but I am very fond of the original movie. There have been two that was made way back when. And one of the things that's astonishing about the picture is that it's established early on that the father of this family is a tough guy. He runs a tight ship. He is the type of person who doesn't take any guff from anybody, and he rules the roost. Okay. So we have to see that established, that he is a terror, because what happens is his son is accused of a crime at school. And we have to say, uh-oh, oh my God, this kid, he's going to kill this kid. And the thing is, no. When the kid says to him, I didn't do it, he believes him and he goes to bat for this kid. But you have to have that sense of, oh my God, oh, this kid is toast. I mean, it's over for this little boy. He is not going to survive. And to see that the father is a man who believes in justice and fair play, even though he's a tough guy, even though he's a hard ass, is really significant. Unfortunately, the director, Lindsay Posner, starts playing it off as a drawing room comedy. And the tone is much too light, and there's a silly Brit fuddy-duddy feeling about everybody in it. And so you don't get this feeling that the father really is such a terror. He isn't even a paper tiger. He isn't even a steel magnolia. I mean, it's amazing to me how he just seems to be this erudite British guy who is just sitting around doing not much of anything. And what I noticed was the fact that the audience was laughing quite a bit. And as a result, when things got serious, at one point there was even a point where things got very serious and the audience was laughing because they had taken the show away from what it was supposed to be. Now, that said, I have to admit that there is a problem with the play itself, because one of the great things in drama, of course, is that you show, you don't tell. And unfortunately, there's a great deal of talk about the courtroom trial. I think the second part of this show should be the trial. I think we should see the trial. That's where it should go, and it doesn't. It stays in that upper middle class house in Britain, and people just come in and say, well, here's what happened today at the trial. So I think there's a problem there as well.
Peter, does the film address that? Is it that way in the film, or do they have the trial?
Well, here I am talking about how wonderful the film is, and I honestly have to say I don't remember, and I was looking for it last night here in my apartment. I couldn't find it. But that is something I want to see, if indeed the movie did take us to the courtroom trial. I suspect it did, because I remember being so riveted by the picture. And yet you say, well, if you're so riveted, how come you don't remember if there was a trial or not? And I'll grant you that. But, I mean, I haven't seen the movie since I was a kid. Mm. And
that was a long time ago.
So as a result, you know, I mean, but what I do remember vividly is the scene that I spoke about, that at the beginning of the, you know, that's what the power of the piece was to me. And I was so devastatedly unhappy last night that wasn't there. The only person I really thought who was successful in this was Charlotte Perry, who plays a grown daughter, who's the case winds up affecting her because she has a man she's supposed to marry. And when he sees what's happening and the public disgrace, and this is really front page news. If you're sitting in the mezzanine, you may not even notice that the newspaper later in the show that's used, it's the headline on the front page. I mean, this really is a big deal, as it turns out. And you know, does a person who's engaged to you think, oh, I better get away from this family. I better distance myself, because after all, this is becoming quite a scandal. And what if they lose? And I mean, the loss of reputation, all that. So Charlotte Perry is terrific in maintaining her dignity there. And again, I don't really blame the other people in the cast. It really is direction. They're doing what they were told to do. but I thought it was frivolous, superficial, and I'm sorry to say that, because I was looking forward to this like crazy. It was going to be one of the highlights of the season for me, and it turned out to be not at all.
Peter, you filled in some blanks for me, which is very helpful, because I have not seen the film, and this is my first exposure to this work. And I was very—I thought it was going to be, you know, what they call a procedural drama on television, like Law and Order. The first half is half is the setup, and the second half is the trial. And when they opened up the second half curtain, and we were back in the house, I said, "Oh, I thought that for sure that the second half was going to be." The courtroom drama, and they did this in four acts with an intermission after the second act, and so the third act I expected to be the courtroom and the fourth one coming back to the house, but they didn't do that, and it was interesting to me because what you're saying now makes more sense to me why I seem to keep getting lost in the story last night, because it was comedy and drama, and you kept on losing track of where you should be, because I thought that there was an outstanding performance by Michael Cumsey, and he plays a barrister, a lawyer who's in love with the daughter and who loses out to another man for the daughter's affections. And I thought he was wonderful, but his role in the show, especially bringing in this legal Johnny Cochran, if you will, this top lawyer in Britain to represent the Winslow boy in the trial, all the levity that was brought in there, I kind of got lost in the seriousness of the story that was happening in front of us. So that it makes more sense, the perspective that you're bringing to it, and that it was lost by bad direction. And because I felt like, oh, it was just 20 minutes too long.
Oh, yeah. I went on a website to find out how long it was, because I was going to 54 Below last night to see the last 5 years. And it said 110 minutes. So I thought, oh, great. I'll be out in time to get there. And I'm telling you, it was not 110 minutes. And no. I have since seen another reference, because I checked today, that says 245. That's legit. You are going to be there for that long, face it. And
don't you hate it when websites or whatever do that? It happens much more often than it should. I mean, are they purposely being fault, you know, are they purposely lying?
Well, the one that I hate, the thing I hate most, is when they give you the running time and they don't include the intermission.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot. You know, I mean, and people don't care how long each act is. They want to know the full amount of time. Right. So saying that it's 2 hours plus a 15-minute intermission, or not mentioning the intermission at all, is stupid, because that's what we want to know. Yes, exactly, James. When are we going to get out? You know, and
we got out last night at like 10:35, 10:40 or something like that.
Yeah, believe me. Yeah, I know, because I had to rush uptown, because I had promised to meet the person I was meeting somewhere between 10:30 and 10:45, and it just wasn't happening. And of course, and try to get a cab on 8th Avenue at that time of night on a Saturday night. So I had to walk very, very quickly to get to 54 Below, where, by the way, for the record, Betsy Wolf and Adam Cantor are still amazing. Sustained Excellence Award this year for them for doing the last 5 years such wonderful justice. It was quite a night. But anyway, and it saved the night, frankly, because I was so disappointed by this. I never thought it was going to end, you know, especially when you are told 110 minutes and then you're still there for a half hour longer. It really is quite painful. Yeah, and I will admit some of this has to do with the fact that this is a refurbished old theater, and as a result, the men's room and the ladies' room aren't as large as they might be. And the lines were incredible for both last night, and I think the intermission was longer than it was supposed to be. But But nevertheless, this is something that this is the second time that Roundabout has disappointed me with the Terrence Rattigan play. Man and Boy, of course, was one. And one can effectively argue that Man and Boy was a later play and it wasn't as good a play as Terrence Rattigan in his prime. But I'm still surprised that Terrence Rattigan thought it was a good idea to have everybody come in and say, well, today in court and yesterday in court and tomorrow in court. And, you know, and when you have that type of thing, somebody's got to rush in and tell you what the verdict is. I mean, is that as nearly as dramatic as, you know, will the defendant rise? You know, Terrence Rattigan let me down here, too, I have to admit.
So I haven't seen the show yet. Is it one set for the entire evening?
It's a unit set.
Wow.
It's the parlor of.
Well, you know, I mean, I suppose that was much more common in those days rather than, you know, because we didn't have the hydraulics that we have now and people change sets at the drop of a hat. But I mean, it wasn't unheard of for shows to have multiple.
No, but it wasn't unheard of, too, for people coming in during intermission and changing sets and, you know, so, I mean, they had ample time to do that. It's funny, writing this book I'm doing about the 63-64 season, Barefoot in the Park, the first time you see that set, it's nothing at all. And then the curtain rises for the second act and everybody goes, ooh, you know, because she's done such a nice job of decorating it. It really is a lovely place now. And I was mentioning how Neil Simon did that a lot.
Yes.
that the second act, the curtain would go up on The Odd Couple, and now that messy apartment was neat, and it would go up in The Star Spangled Girl, and indeed the messy apartment was neat because a woman had moved in, and in God's Favorite, just the opposite. The house had been devastated during intermission. God had taken out his wrath on Joe Benjamin, and now suddenly the house that was beautiful, the mansion, was now a charred mess. So, you know, it's there's plenty of time to change during intermission, you know, to a courtroom set, and I'm surprised that Terrence Rattigan didn't.
So that's The Winslow Boy. Michael, you're going to see this later this week?
Yes, I'm seeing it on Tuesday, so I'll let
report
you know
back.
But it is interesting. I mean, it is interesting. As Peter said, I think that the reviews have been very largely very positive.
Yeah. Oh, this is a minority report, no question.
Yeah. So I, you know, but also let me parenthetically throw in quickly that I got to see The Last 5 Years also this week. I saw it earlier than Peter, and actually the night I saw it, Jason Robert Brown was playing, which was extraordinary. But yes, yeah, that was amazing to see those guys recreate. And, you know, I guess this relates to sort of to what we were saying about the Janis Joplin show. I mean, this was a concert presentation of The Last 5 Years, no set, and you know, just the one character getting up to sing after another. And even though the show, you know, I mean, the show is written that way, but it wasn't a theatrical setting, and yet there was so much drama in the
evening.
You bet.
And
those two, Adam Cantor and Betsy Wolf, who we were lucky enough to have on the podcast last week, just really amazing. And that score, I still can't get over what a masterpiece it is. And I cannot wait to see the film, which I've heard from at least two different people who've seen rough cuts of it is really quite something. So,
well, Kurt Deutsch was there last night, and he says that they still have to sell it. You know, they haven't got their distributor yet. And,
oh, really? Yeah.
Well, he didn't quite use the word distributor, but he did say that they still have to sell it.
Right.
Now, maybe I misinterpreted him. Maybe all he meant was when it opens, we have to do business. But I really got the impression it was still a step away from truly, truly being shown.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm wrong. You know, maybe that's all he meant was we still have to sell it. We have to get people in the seats. Maybe that's what he meant. But he's the power behind it. And I mean, it's really very gracious of him to do it. Because, of course, his wife, Sharon A. Scott, was the original woman in the piece, and of course, she's not the star of this, you know, because time has passed. And so it's very nice that he's been loyal to this piece in that way. So,
you know, Peter, you unfortunately weren't here when we with Betsy, because I know you're a big fan of hers from way back. But so you may not know that she mentioned that she has a cameo in the film.
Yeah, you know, I'm told that a lot of people who have been connected with the last 5 years are going to actually be in the film, or are in the film, and I think that's really great. So we're going to have a good time celebrity watching, you know, Broadway celebrity watching. The rest of the country may not say, oh, look at that, there's Betsy Wolf, but of course we will. So, indeed.
All right, well, speaking of celebrity watching... Mm-hmm. We were down, Michael and I, I think we saw the same performance of Romeo and Juliet at Classic Stage Company. Isn't that correct, Michael?
Yes.
I think so, yeah. And so...
yes, and so this is going to be one of those cases where we cannot say...
saw a different performance, you know.
Because it's interesting, because I think James really liked it, and I really, really disliked it intensely.
Well, I was sitting on the left side of the house, and you were sitting on the right side of the house. So maybe that's the issue there. But as Michael said, I like this production much better than the Broadway production. And I thought that Michael, why don't you introduce it and talk about it before we, get into it?
I mean, I probably shouldn't say too much because my reaction was so negative, and I think it all has to do with the director Taya, Alagic with an accent aigu, I guess. I have no idea how to say that. I'm sorry, Alagic.
The director of the Classic Stage Company production.
Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, directed by Taya Alagic.
I was saying was that we'll just call it him or her Taya? Or
Taya. Yeah, Taya. It's a she. Yes, and actually, I mean, I have to say, right off the bat, it says in her bio that she holds an MFA in directing from Yale School of Drama. But it also turns out she's a woman from Bosnia, and I wonder if maybe that has factored into some of the opportunities she's gotten. Because on the basis of this production, oh my God. I mean, there was nothing. It was completely blank space with no props or scenery other than a long metal table and a line of chairs lined up along the back wall. And the chairs were hardly ever used except when people were throwing them around at some point. The table, I think, was maybe only used once when as the Romeo and Juliet's bed. And it, you know, it just... there was this weird concept of having actors suddenly start speaking in foreign languages. They would, you know, they would be doing the normal text, and then suddenly they would launch into another language. It was most often Spanish, but at one point early on, one of the other actors in the fight scene at the beginning. I'm not sure what it was. Some
Russian, Russian or Polish or something. Like that?
Some Slavic language. Yeah. I didn't understand what the point of that was supposed to be. There was no kind of nothing like we have in the Broadway production where they were trying to, say that one faction was African American. One group, you know, one family was African American. The Capulets and the Montagues were Caucasian. There was no consistency in people seeming to represent specific different factions like that. And also on that note, as I said, the show starts with the fight scene. I got the impression that there were tremendous cuts in this production made at the last minute. And the reason I say that is, aside from everything else, Daniel Davis, who's the best thing in it, in my opinion, is billed as both the chorus and Friar Lawrence. But in Romeo and Juliet, the chorus only appears at the beginning and delivers that speech. I mean, the chorus, whether it's a group of people or one person as the chorus, delivers that speech to households in enmity, these 2 hours traffic on our stage, blah, blah, blah. That speech was not there. It was completely cut. And so was the final speech, which I believe is normally delivered by the prince. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
And that speech was also cut, I think, in the Broadway production. So both productions also cut the bit that I mentioned when we reviewed the Broadway production of Paris coming to the tomb at the end, Juliet's tomb, and being slain by Romeo. So don't think you're going to see most of Romeo and Juliet if you see either of these shows, aside from everything else, that every other problem that each of them may have. I don't want to say much more. I think Romeo and Juliet, I don't think this is a superficial thing to say, but I think this is a case where it really is important that both of the title roles be very attractive people. And in this case, I don't think that was true at all. I do think where's Elizabeth Olsen? I wanted to make sure I got her first name right. As Juliet is very pretty, but her beauty was played down, so that wasn't an issue. And they do strange things, like if you read the New York Times review, there was even a photo of it when Romeo meets Juliet at the ball, and it's supposed to be love at first sight. He's got this huge Winnie the Pooh mask on, not even a mask, a false head. And it's like, well, you know, what is she of? What do they call those people? Furries? Ah. People who apparently have this fetish of like furry animals. They get excited by that. She can't see his face. How can she fall in love with him at first sight? That was one of the 10,000 missteps in this incredibly misconceived production, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think what I liked best about it was I felt that the Romeo and Juliet had much more chemistry than in the Condola Rashad and...
Yeah, and apparently you are not alone in that. I completely disagree. I certainly felt that. And I wasn't present for when you guys discussed the Broadway one, so that was interesting. I guess I wanted to just again make the point with that. In that case, I just felt that the play carried the day, and that whatever the flaws of the Broadway production were, and as significant as they were, none of them really worked against the play to the point where it was less effective than it should be. But I didn't feel that at all here. On Broadway, gosh, guys, I mean, that kiss between the two of them, didn't you feel chemistry there at least? I mean, that was one of the longest, deepest, most erotic kisses I've ever seen on a stage in my life. I mean, I guess maybe you're not talking about that specific moment, but I know I thought those two did have, I really did feel that they had chemistry. But I also will note that I feel like that's one of the most subjective things that critics or audiences can ever discuss. Whether two characters have chemistry or not is so subjective. So I guess maybe we should leave it at that.
All right. So let's move forward. Peter got a chance to see Fun Home. Peter, tell us about that.
Fun Home actually means funeral home we're dealing with a situation where a family in Pennsylvania, the father works at a funeral home. He also teaches English at a local college, and he's a very good father, as we see from Michael Cerberus right at the beginning. He gives his daughter and son, two daughters, one son, time, attention, and he's so nice to them and so on and so forth. If only he weren't gay. If only he weren't going out at night looking and cruising and finding people and getting arrested. Ironically enough, I want to be very cautious about the way I put this. The daughter we get to meet, Allison, is a chip off the old block because she's gay too. So they do have that in common, and it's really interesting towards the end of the show when they both come together in a car ride, and she tries to discuss it, and it's still too hard for him. One of the things that's so difficult about being a father is that you get used to having this child grow up and think you're the sun and the moon early on. And then, of course, as the kid gets smarter and sees that you are not the sun and the moon, more judgments are made as time goes on. And this is very well expressed in this show. The fact that that so many parents do have feet of clay, even if this is not an issue with them, that you do see a parent's flaws as you get older. And the problem is of being a parent is that you continue to be a parent even when you don't want to be a parent, even when your kid doesn't need you to be a parent, that you are still giving advice, you're still saying this, you still expect your word to be law, and that there's an expiration date on that. And that's very well shown in this show. Michael Cerveris is marvelous, no question about it. He always is, but he really is quite sensational. By the way, the girl Allison is played by three different actresses in the show, and boy, the one who plays her as a teenager, who's just finding her way and realizing she's becoming a lesbian, a woman named Alexandra Socha, is phenomenal beyond belief. She goes to school. She knows how she feels. She meets a girl who's ahead of her sexually, and she's having a real tough time with that. And yet, once she gives into it, of course, and she realizes this is who she is, she has a marvelous song about the fact that this is how she wants to spend her college years, that she is majoring in Joan. And it's a very smart idea. There's also a marvelous song in which the three little kids envision a commercial, a TV commercial for the funeral home. And it's a lot of black humor, and it's very, very funny, and the kids are terrific. It's a wonderful cast. Lisa Krohn has done an astonishing job with book and lyrics here. I know this is based on a graphic novel. I don't know if indeed it's very close to the graphic novel or not, but the story is extraordinarily well told, and it's very, very moving. And Janine Tesori's music is very, very successful. Again, Janine is not writing in the Thoroughly Modern Millie mold, of course. She's writing more in the Carolina Change mold. So this is not the type of score where there are AABA songs in abundance. There's a lot of feeling of, well, I don't want to say recitative because it's more structured than that, but nevertheless, it's more free flowing type of a score than a traditional score, but it suits it very, very well. A wonderful production at the Newman Theater. It's nice to be back in the Newman and seeing a musical. It doesn't happen often enough down there, and but it really, really is so, so moving as you see this poor soul struggling with his sexuality, and also seeing his daughter having far less of a difficult time with it for a couple of reasons. One, that she's of a younger generation and times have changed and there's more acceptance. That's certainly a part of it. But also, you know, like it or not, in our society, society judges lesbians far less harshly than gay men, and that's certainly in there as well. I'm glad to hear you grunt that, Michael. I was reluctant to say that, there is still that. It's even been said that men watching lesbians in a movie doing it is even considered a great indication of heterosexuality. Right. I've read that, you know. So the thing is, it's a bit easier on Allison than it is on her daddy. And certainly what happens in the show indicates that tremendously well. This is a major piece. I hope it's going to move to Broadway. It would be very significant in the Tony race. And we have a number of contenders here, you know, that could very well be remembered come next June. But this one really deserves a tremendous public and a tremendous reception when all is said and done.
Peter, the title, is it by any chance like the Hot L Baltimore, where it's that the Fun Home refers to a sign where some of the letters are out, or is it?
No, that's a good guess. Okay. It's just that they noticed that, fun is part of the word funeral, even though it's pronounced differently. So, no, it's not that. But it's a clever title under the circumstances, and because you don't expect to go in there and actually see at one point Michael Cerberus with his white coat on, you know, tending to a body, you know, that's that's in there too. So a lot of cultural references. There's a TV on stage that you will see Jim Nabors, you will see Dinah Shore.
Really.
Oh yeah, you will see the Brady Bunch. This is all significant stuff that occurs in the show. So, the idea of having the grown up Allison as the observer, she doesn't have that much to do technically. She's basically observing what's going on with the with her younger selves, and. But she does get her scene at the end with her father, and it's a most impressive one. A truly good, if not great, musical.
So June Thomas over at Slate Magazine.
Oh, I know June. Yeah. Lovely lady.
Recommended this show on the Slate Culture Gabfest last week. And she was talking about how she was a fan of the graphic novel before the show, and she had mentioned that it was very true to the graphic novel. And I know that you had brought that up, so I wanted to mention that. And you can check out June Thomas at the Slate Culture Gab Fest. It's a really wonderful podcast as well.
Hey, good.
So,
very good to me.
All right, so let's move on to the last show we're going to talk about this morning. Michael got a chance to see How to Be a New Yorker, which is, Michael, am I correct here? Is it planning at the screening room of Planet Hollywood?
Yes, it's a new space within Planet Hollywood. Not a very large space at all. I counted, and I would say that maybe it would seat like about 50 or 60 at absolute capacity. It's table seating, and there is food with your admission price beforehand. You're asked to get there about a half hour beforehand for an Italian buffet. And then the show itself is only about an hour and 15 minutes long. And that's an honest, cut. Right. So for everyone who cares. And it's just a really delightful show. It had played quite some months, in the basement of Sophia's restaurant over on 46th Street. But I think that space is now no longer being used for theatrical purposes. So they have moved to Planet Hollywood. And it's just a very delightful show with a cast of two. Kevin James Doyle and Margaret Copeland are the two actors. And I think it doesn't actually say, but I think they wrote it also. And it's just a bunch of blackout skits, no music, blackout skits about various subjects, you know, dealing with how to be a New Yorker. Sometimes the actors play historical people from New York past. Sometimes they play tourists. Sometimes they play current day New Yorkers. And there are really funny things in it. And one major plus is that unlike the Janis Joplin show that we were discussing before, this is a show that manages to bring the audience into it without bludgeoning them. I mean, they have like little quizzes like safe or unsafe. One question is, eating food from vendor carts, safe or unsafe? and then you have to answer, and they say, actually, it's very safe because those carts have to be cleaned and sanitized every morning, and they actually have higher sanitary standards than regular restaurants. And then he says, well, you know, that's the law anyway. We don't know if they follow it. Safer unsafe was Hell's Kitchen. And the woman guessed unsafe, and he goes, no, Hell's Kitchen is one of the safest neighborhoods in the world. You know, and it used to be one of the worst, but now it's filled with high-rise apartments and trendy restaurants. So it's really funny things. There's one point where somebody plays Robert Moses. Kevin James Doyle plays Robert Moses, and Margaret Copeland plays his nemesis, that woman whose name I can't remember, but the woman who's credited with with stopping much of his destruction of the city. So it's a great time. I got a press comp, so I'm not sure, but I think it's very reasonably priced. As I was leaving, two women were talking and saying what a great deal it was for the food and the show. So I would definitely check it out. And as I say, it ran for quite some time at Sophia, so they must be doing something right, and people must be really enjoying it.
The tickets are $59.
Oh, see, yeah.
And the lunch dinner menu, lunch begins at 1:30, dinner begins at 7 p.m. There's a house salad, a spaghetti marinara, a fettuccine alfredo, a chicken parmigiana, and a cookies and brownies. Ooh, cookies and brownies.
Yeah, they were really good. Especially the oatmeal raisin were really excellent.
They had me at cookies, but brownies is just extra. All righty. So I guess that's about it. Jim Randolph's got you to go to it.
Yes.
Excellent. All right.
Well, I had seen it at Sophia's, and I really liked it. So I was perfectly happy to go back again. And actually, you know, it seemed even funnier to me. I don't know if it was the audience was better, or maybe they sharpened it even more. But I'd say even funnier than it was.
All right. So let's wrap it up. We've run very long this week. And I will sign off by saying you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way you can click the link that says subscribe, and each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream us directly to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Information for contacting Peter, Michael, or me is at broaderradio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. If you do have a moment, please stop by iTunes and leave a review for us, because iTunes reviews help others find us more easily, and a good review will raise us in the rankings in iTunes, and they will promote us better there. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In our elegant triplex on Third Avenue, floating high above Trinity Park, we've a view of the Triborough Bridge, triple sec in the fridge, and a loo that is truly divine. For it's rub-a-dub-dub in a three-corner tub with the towels marked his, and mine. I'd adore to go soaring too high in the sky in a tri-motor plane with a guy and a guy, but I ask for no more than to gaze into four eyes of blue in a cottage for three.